monetary affairs hardly entered Dad's mind at all, and soon slipped away entirely, to be fielded by Mom. This despite the fact that his study was a model of efficiency and organization, as were the stories he wrote in there. He was also highly organized when it came to affairs of the kitchen, since he so loved to cook. He kept kitchen pans and utensils clean, and of utmost importance to him, kept them in exacting locations in cupboards and drawers, near where they would be used. Baking dishes were by the oven, pans by the range, and so on. He called it point-of-use storage. Because of his inattention to financial details, he had a tendency to overspend, and to buy impulsively. Mom was constantly reining him in, reminding him of stark economic realities. Frank and Beverly Herbert were more content in Port Townsend than any place they'd ever lived before, and in large measure their happiness came from the beauty of the land itself, and from their attention to improving it. With my grandmother's help, they planted roses, rhododendrons, hydrangeas, bougainvillea, poinsettia, and geraniums along the driveway and around the front of the house. Mom poured coffee grounds around roses and other plants, saying that something in the chemistry was good for the plants. The results bore this out. By mail order, they obtained seeds for trees and seedlings, and they planted giant sequoias, redwoods, firs, sugar maples, and dogwoods. Based upon research my father did, they kept the giant sequoia seedlings in a refrigerator for 2 months before planting them, simulating winter temperatures at a young age in order to improve the odds of their surviving through the first real winter. Above the duck pond stood an old apple, pear, and plum orchard, where they added young apricot, crabapple, and filbert trees. They researched wine grapes carefully, hoping to find varieties that would do well in the cool northern latitudes. It was a risky proposition, but near the orchard they planted a small experimental vineyard of Merlot, Sauvignon Blanc, and Cabernet Sauvignon. At the top of a hill overlooking the orchard, vineyard, and duck pond, they constructed three large stone-walled vegetable and low-growing fruit garden areas, with drainage holes in the walls to keep excess moisture from damaging the plants. In Frank Herbert's studies of Native American planting methods, he discovered that they often planted corn in circles. Supposedly, this was for religious reasons, since the circle had spiritual significance to them. But after several seasons, Dad discovered a practical reason as well. Higher yields were produced. Subsequently, he employed a variation on circles, spirals, and obtained even higher yields.
Dad had a poultry house built, connected to a wire-screened enclosure, and filled it with nearly 100 Rhode Island Reds, prolific brown egg layers, and other breeds of chickens, and 30 ducks.
Turkeys became occasional, if short-term, visitors before they were relocated onto a dinner table or into one of the freezers in the main house. And there were a pair of geese living in the yard, a working couple who earned their keep by weeding the garden. Some of the ducks were Rouans from France, examples of genetic engineering that looked like dark-feathered mallards but grew much faster and didn't fly well. A meat breed, they laid green, blue, or tinted white eggs. They were allowed to forage around the pond, an unfenced area, and in this way were able to come up with most of their own food, supplemented by small amounts of grain left around the shores of the pond by Dad. He also stocked the pond with tubers and salamanders, for the ducks, freshwater clams, pond snails, and bass. Always thinking of the interrelationships of an ecosystem, my father said that duck droppings sealed the bottom of the pond better than concrete. In his travels to third world countries, Frank Herbert learned about high-yield hybrid rice, which he wanted to plant on the shores of the pond. He set up bird feeders on trees all around the main house, including on a fir outside Mom's office, so that she could watch activity at the feeder from her desk. Dad referred to birds as feathered insect killers, and said they kept insect levels down on his patio and decks during summer months when insect populations were highest. My parents were amateur bird watchers and frequently went for long walks in the woods together, taking binoculars and Audubon bird collars. Doing most of the construction work by himself, Dad put together a fancy Lord and Burnham greenhouse adjacent to the house. When the structure was complete, they used it in the winter to get an edge on the growing season, keeping plants inside during the cold months and then planting them at the first opportunity in the springtime. They kept warm-weather fruit trees in the greenhouse year-round, providing their table with fresh lemons, limes, oranges, and figs. They also grew strawberries in there. Dad arose early each day to write, before Mom or Babe were up. After a small breakfast of unbuttered whole wheat toast with jam or honey and freshly squeezed orange juice, he was at work on Arrakis by 5:30 or 6. He continued without interruption until noon or early afternoon, depending upon where he was in the story. Friends and family were instructed never to call him before noon. After lunch, Dad did farm work, often involving heavy manual labor. To compensate for the sedentary life of a writer, he liked getting his hands dirty and exercising in fresh air. He and Mom often said the earth calmed them as they gardened, when they immersed their hands in the soil. One day, when my daughter Julie was upset, they suggested that she go outside and do this. It worked for her, and the farm benefited as well from the weeds that they suggested she pull. My father designed and built a number of farm gadgets, including an enclosure for the garbage cans, with a lid that propped itself open, a brush, nailed bristles up to the deck by the front door for cleaning mud from shoes, and a funnel arrangement, nailed to a tree by the chicken house for draining fowl he had slaughtered. It was an efficient farm, producing the fresh makings of fabulous gourmet meals, which we shared with them often. Each morning, awakening with our stomachs pleasantly full from the evening before, we heard the crowing of roosters. Frank Herbert was the most famous person in town, and liked by every level of the social strata, from contractors to professors. They helped him guard his privacy. Whenever an outsider came to town looking for Frank Herbert, no one seemed to know where he lived. When Howie Hansen's best friend became famous, for a time Howie didn't know how to relate. It wasn't the same to him, no matter how he tried to achieve the closeness they had known in the past. Finally, Howie initiated a heart-to-heart conversation. Dad told him he was very skittish of people who wanted to know him only after they found out he wrote a book. "You're different, Howie," he said. "You know me as a guy who runs a typewriter, and I know you as a guy who runs a fishing boat. There isn't a lot of difference from one person to another when you look at it that way." After this, Howie was more relaxed. Another time, Dad showed Howie a manuscript he was about to mail to New York. Dad noticed an error and said, laughing, "Look at that. I haven't even got this word spelled right." He left it misspelled and quipped, "I'm not proving myself as a typist, Howie. I'm proving myself as a writer." Actually, Dad was just having a little fun with Howie, enjoying his success. My father was an excellent speller and always prided himself on clean manuscripts sent to publishers. He was such a perfectionist, in fact, that he sometimes reopened envelopes in the post office before mailing them out, just to change a few words. For 16 months, my parents led a busy but idyllic life at Xanadu, their Port Townsend property. In the middle of April 1974, they were scheduled to fly to New York City for an important meeting with one of Dad's publishers. Then the world fell out from under them. For several weeks, Beverly Herbert had been experiencing congestion in her lungs, and after taking antibiotics prescribed by her family doctor, the condition wasn't getting better. In the middle of the night, her condition worsened, and she couldn't stop coughing. At 2:30 a.m., Dad telephoned a friend who owned a small plane and asked if he could fly them to Seattle right away to get Mom to Group Health Hospital. The answer was yes, so Dad bundled Mom up and helped her downstairs to their 1966 Volvo sedan, then drove to the small county airport just outside Port Townsend. On the way, he reached speeds in excess of 100 miles an hour. In the air, the pilot radioed ahead to Seattle and arranged for an ambulance to meet them at Boeing Field. In the ambulance, half an hour later, with red lights flashing, Dad was at my mother's side holding her hand and telling her she was going to be all right. A paramedic assured him he wasn't in the way and worked around him, taking Mom's vital signs and radioing them to emergency room personnel waiting at the hospital. On the way, she kept saying, "I can't go to the hospital. We have to be in New York." "Don't worry about it," Dad said. From the hospital, Dad telephoned me. It was dawn, and I was just getting up for work. He said Mom had a collapsed lung, and there were ominous indications of even more serious problems. Jan and I bundled up the children, Julie was 6 and Kim 2, and rushed to the hospital. Mom was in intensive care, and the children weren't allowed in her room. I went to see her first, leaving Jan in the waiting room with the kids. My mother appeared pale, but smiled weakly when she saw me. Her eyes looked pained and murky. She had an intravenous line connected to one arm, with a plastic bottle hanging from a portable metal frame nearby. Clear liquid in the bottle bubbled as it fed through the line into her body.
A book of Emily Dickinson poems and a Vogue magazine sat on a rolling cart to her left.
Dad was slumped in a straight-backed chair on her other side, looking very tired. "Did you shave this morning?" she asked, looking at me closely. Sheepishly, I admitted I hadn't. I felt like a little boy under scrutiny for dirt behind the ears. She smiled gently. I waited while doctors tended to her. She said she had a collapsed lung from pneumonia, but assured me everything was fine. It was being taken care of well, she said. And I recalled but did not mention the fact that pneumonia had killed her mother, Marguerite, at the age of 51. As I stood looking down on my mother, I thought of her age, 47. The doctors wanted each visit kept short, so I had to leave after a few minutes. Dad walked out in the hall with me, saying he needed to stop at the cafeteria to get a cup of coffee. He said he would check into a hotel near the hospital that evening to be near Mom. "You can stay with us," I offered. But he declined, saying our house was small, and besides, he wanted to remain closer to Mom. Jan went in to see Mom afterward, and I didn't learn until the following year what transpired during their conversation.
Mom told her she didn't have pneumonia at all, that what she had told me had not been true.
From X-rays, the doctors strongly suspected lung cancer, and further tests were being conducted. She said if it was cancer, she didn't think I was strong enough to hear the news. "You're stronger than Brian," my mother said. "I don't want him to know yet. He's like me. He'll be up worrying all night." Mom said she'd known for several weeks something was seriously wrong, but she'd been afraid to see a doctor about it. On a number of occasions, she had repeated to herself the litany against fear, written so beautifully in Dune by her loving husband. "I must not fear. Fear is the mind killer. Fear is the little death that brings total obliteration. I will face my fear. I will permit it to pass over me and through me, and when it has gone past, I will turn the inner eye to see its path. Where the fear has gone, there will be nothing. Only I will remain." She had been lying awake at night, depressed and worrying over her condition and how she would pay bills. Dad had been writing checks and transferring funds between accounts without leaving a clear paper trail that she could follow. Inside, Jan didn't feel strong at all, but she tried not to show this. She was falling apart herself, fighting back tears. Unable to speak, she hugged the woman who had become a mother figure to her. After a long while, Jan pulled away and said, "I love you, Bev. I'll pray for you." "I love you, too." Mom's eyes were moist, filled with pain at the thought of separation. "I'm getting the best care. The doctors are doing everything possible." In a short time, without my knowledge, my mother was diagnosed with inoperable terminal lung cancer, apparently caused by having been a heavy smoker during most of her life.
2 daily packs of Lucky Strikes, a brand having extremely high quantities of tar, nicotine, and carbon monoxide, had taken their toll.
They called it squamous cell carcinoma, and it was in the region of the left upper lobe. Mom was especially despondent upon hearing a doctor tell a nurse, "Let her have whatever she wants." It meant that they were giving up on her, that as far as they were concerned, it didn't matter what painkiller drugs she took or what she ate. She obtained opinions from 2 physicians, and the most optimistic prognosis gave her only a 5% chance of surviving beyond 6 months. Thereafter, she began a rigorous program of chemotherapy and cobalt radiation treatments. Dad canceled his New York City appointments. He also slowed his work on Arrakis, riding only a few hours a day or not at all, so that he could concentrate upon his new priority, helping Mom find the best medical attention possible. While she was undergoing treatment, he was burning up the telephone wires, asking everyone he could think of for advice. He wanted the best technology available for Mom, even if he had to take her out of the country to get it. Radiation and chemotherapy were attacking the disease from 2 directions, and he was zeroing in on a 3rd, the possibility of a trip to Mexico for Laetril, also known as the vitamin B17 treatment, derived from apricot pits. Her odds were low, and he wanted to give her every extra fraction of a percentage point that he could. As a result of his investigation, Dad decided that Mom's best opportunity lay with chemotherapy and radiation in the United States, followed by Laetrol treatments in Mexico, since they were not legal in the U.S. Laetrol was developed in France in 1840, and by the 1970s it was a fad cancer cure, replacing another fad cure of the 1960s, crebiazin. By the 1980s, most medical authorities felt there was no evidence of any anti-cancer properties in Laetrol. Dad's mother, Babe, sent a Catholic nun, Sister M. Jean of St. Leo Convent, all the way from Tacoma to see her. The nun gave her a set of rosary beads, along with a scapular. When Sister M. Jean returned to the convent, she supervised 20 nuns in prayer sessions for my mother. Despite a lifelong aversion to organized religion, Mom graciously accepted the attention. Over the years, she had come to regret the lack of a relationship with God in her life, and at the brink, she was trying to make up for lost time. My mother and father rarely spoke to me of religion when I was living with them. Mom explained this was because religion had been shoved down their throats when they were children, and they did not want to inflict anything like that upon Bruce, Penny, or me. They wanted us to make our own decisions about God, with all choices open to us. Later in her life, Mom would have a change of heart, saying our lack of religious experience gave us nothing to fall back upon during times of extreme difficulty. In her own way, she would one day form a strong relationship with God. 5 weeks after the awful diagnosis, during a time when my mother was undergoing chemotherapy and radiation treatments in Seattle, Jan telephoned her. Mom said the treatments were hard on her, and she was sick to her stomach. She asked if Jan had told me. No, Jan replied. Don't. It's for the best. I'm fighting this thing, Jan, and I'll be damned if it's going to get me. Not when Frank and I have reached the point where we can begin enjoying our accomplishments. A month later, she received good news. Her body was responding to treatment, and the cancer was in remission. The doctors said it was a miracle, that she had developed a warrior spirit in order to survive. My parents still planned to go to Mexico for Laetrol later in the year just to play it safe, to employ every possible cure. While receiving radiation treatment, however, Mom's heart had sustained irreparable and serious damage, destroying 1/4 of the muscle. The medical process, which left quite a bit to be desired but was the state of the art at the time, involved the administration of more than 5,000 rads of irradiation to her left main stem bronchus, lung, through a single anterior port, with no shielding of the heart. Now, while she was much improved overall, her heart condition caused her to tire easily. Doctors prescribed an exercise program that involved swimming. Dad refinanced the house to obtain funds, and arranged for the rush construction of a swimming pool on the property and a cedar pool building. He had a custom weather vane installed on the roof of the new structure, with a rider's quill for a wind direction arrow. The pool water was kept pleasantly warm for Mom, and Dad made sure that she completed the swimming exercises she needed. If she ever had trouble finishing a lap, he was right there to help her to the edge. With Arthur P. Jacobs deceased, his company, Apjack International, was still uncertain if they would exercise their option to film Dune. The option was about to come due, and with a higher mortgage payment and the extra, uninsured medical treatments that Dad wanted Mom to receive in Mexico, they were in need of the money this would bring in.
Marvel Comics had made an offer to print a Dune comic book, but Dad was not enthusiastic about the idea. He delayed responding.
For the first time in 2.5 months, he had Arrakis rolling again. A gut feeling told him this book would be tremendously successful, but his hardcover publisher, Putnam, was cautious. They paid a small advance and were talking about a limited print run.
While awaiting word from Apjack, Dad taught a writing workshop at the Symposium in Creative Print, conducted in Fort Worden State Park, Port Townsend.
The 1982 movie An Officer and a Gentleman was filmed there. His uncle, Ken Roundtree Sr., had commanded this U.S. Army fort in the 1940s, before it was decommissioned and turned into a state park. A young Port Townsend poet, Bill Ransom, was director of the workshop. In a short time, they would become fast friends, and then collaborators on a number of book projects. When Mom finally returned to her desk, she found it overflowing with unpaid bills, unread contracts, and unanswered letters. By the fall, she was feeling much better and could swim 3 laps of the pool. I was told only that she was recovering from the lung condition that had been described to me earlier, pneumonia, and I had no idea of the suffering she had experienced. I did hear her complaining about cold, damp weather, so typical of the Pacific Northwest, and I later learned that the radiation treatment had contributed to this condition. Her radiation-damaged heart wasn't pumping as much oxygen as before, so that her circulatory system wasn't working well. Her weight loss undoubtedly made her feel colder, too. She told me she had stopped smoking, and I had to get used to seeing her in the new way, without the customary cigarette in her hand or in an ashtray nearby. In a few months, she could do 40 laps of the pool nonstop, around 500 meters in all. She had been a strong swimmer before her illness, had even placed first in an all-city swim meet in her youth. Apjack did not renew their option to film Dune, which came as a financial blow to my parents. In October, however, they received substantial royalties from still burgeoning Dune sales, more than enough to pay their bills, including a Mexico vacation by car. Or so I was told. The Marvel Comics offer for a Dune comic book was not accepted. Reflecting good sales of The Dragon in the Sea and a poorly named paperback version, 21st Century Sub, Ballantine came out with a new Classics edition using yet another title for the same story. This was the original Under Pressure title from a magazine serialization, Astounding Science Fiction, November 1955 through January 1956. The sales of all Frank Herbert novels increased with the amazing success of Dune, and his publishers, domestic and foreign, scrambled to reissue the old material. In a reader's poll conducted by Locus, the newspaper of the science fiction field, Dune was voted the greatest science fiction novel of all time. Just before departing for Mexico in mid-October, Dad completed the second draft of Arrakis, the long-awaited climax of the Dune trilogy. He renamed it Children of Dune, and planned to write the final draft upon his return. Upon returning from their trip in early December 1974, good news awaited them. A French production company led by Michel Seydoux was making a substantial offer for the right to film Dune. The offer was accepted, and their advance provided welcome financial breathing room. Seydoux, a millionaire Parisian, obtained the Chilean director Alejandro Jodorowsky for the project. Jodorowsky, director of the controversial cult films El Topo and The Holy Mountain, was a brilliant eccentric with left-wing political views. The budget was set at $9,500,000, substantially lower than Arthur P. Jacobs's $15 million, especially considering inflation in the intervening years. But Jodorowsky planned to film in Spain and the deserts of Algeria, where costs were not excessive. He was confident he could come in under budget. Jodorowsky wrote the screenplay and proceeded with storyboarding, the creation of special effects, set construction, and costume making. He also reached tentative casting agreements with an interesting group of actors. Jodorowsky intended to play Duke Leto Atreides himself, while Orson Welles would be Baron Vladimir Harkonnen. The surrealistic artist and filmmaker Salvador Dali would be the Padishah Emperor, Shaddam IV. David Carradine would be Imperial Ecologist Dr. Kynes, and Charlotte Rampling would be Lady Jessica. Jodorowsky hoped to reach agreement with either Mick Jagger or Pink Floyd to do the soundtrack. Dad was slated to be technical advisor, but quipped in an interview with Bill Ransom that this meant third assistant flunky. Now he was on the home stretch of Children of Dune, Arrakis, and expected to finish the book in 5 or 6 weeks. Chapter 22, Children of Dune. One snowy winter day in early 1975, Jan took me aside and told me how ill my mother had been. I was stunned and immensely proud of my father when I learned all the wonderful things he had done for Mom, setting his important work aside and taking her to Mexico to improve her odds at life. As this new and very human side of my father revealed itself to me, I began inquiring about him. I asked my mother about their early years together and other times when I hadn't been around. For years, my mother's dependency upon him had been obvious. She didn't even have a driver's license, and for much of her life had yielded to his decisions, to his changing whims. Her method of influence had been one of unflagging love and constancy, of enduring his mood swings and pushing him gradually towards settling into a property of their own. Now, This was the Port Townsend house. Xanadu. Skillfully, she had brought him around not only by asserting that it would make her happy, but by showing him it was the only way he could have a farm and the ecological demonstration projects he wanted. Much of her life had been spent waiting for him to complete a story so that they could do things together. This was a micro and macro pattern of relationship. She waited to see him each day until he emerged from his study, when they could share private times together. Romantic dinners and walks in the woods, boat trips, times shared in the garden and swimming pool. And she waited even longer for him, months and years, to take trips after Dad finally finished each book. Everything they did revolved around his writing schedule. He was dominant, the one in charge. But he was vulnerable, I came to realize. Vulnerable without her. They were a remarkable writing team. If my mother was ill, he couldn't write. Not until she felt better. They flowed together as one organism. Howie Hansen put it this way. There are two Frank Herberts. The one I knew prior to Bev, and the one that you know who was created by Bev. Frank Herbert, the author, would not exist had there not been a Beverly Forbes to marry him and coalesce him mentally. Over the years, I had been mailing items from my office joke file to my mother. With her illness, it occurred to me that my light fare might be therapeutic, might perk her up. So I increased my schedule of mailings to her. She posted her favorites on bulletin boards in the kitchen and in her office. Mom and Dad made their second trip to Europe in late 1975. Just before leaving, Mom took me into her office in one of the bedroom wings and said, almost matter-of-factly, "If we fall out of the sky, Brian, I want you to take care of things." I hated hearing her talk like that, particularly with the way I felt about flying. In 1968, I had an unfortunate experience while taking a flying lesson in a single-engine Piper Colt, an incident where, due to the error of my instructor, we nearly collided with an airliner. Since that time, I had not flown, and had vowed I would never do so again in any sort of aircraft. Mom went on to give me the combination to their home safe and to a padlock on a file box. She had me stand beside the desk while she opened the third drawer down and showed me where keys to the desk and file cabinets were kept, under a book of zip codes. The safe deposit box key was on a separate keychain. More keys on a big brass ring were hidden in the master bathroom, keys to the various locks around the property. She showed me a list of Dad's publications, kept in an orange notebook, and the location of the contract files. "Be sure to renew the copyrights every 28 years," Mom said. She told me which ones were coming up soon, and mentioned a recent renewal on the first published work in his Opus files, Survival of the Cunning, published in Esquire in March 1945. As we came out of the office, my 7-year-old daughter Julie was seated on a kitchen stool next to her grandfather, sharing ice cream with him. His hair was thinning on top, and she asked him, wondering about the origin of his beard, "Grandpa, did the hair from the top of your head slip onto your face?" He let out a loud guffaw. A 4-part analog serialization of Children of Dune in early 1976 was a resounding success, causing issues to sell out on newsstands. Letters poured in from excited fans who loved the story. But at 3 a.m. on a holiday, President's Day, 1976, Beverly Herbert became extremely ill. Dad rushed her to Jefferson General Hospital in Port Townsend. It was a medication problem from post-cancer treatment medicines she had been taking, causing dangerous changes in her vital signs. Medical personnel arranged to fly her to Group Health Hospital in Seattle for more specialized attention. At Group Health, she was kept overnight and her medications were adjusted. The Group Health doctor told her the emergency room technician at Jefferson General had saved her life by making a difficult diagnosis and then obtaining the proper care for her. For months, David Hartwell, Dad's astute editor at Putnam, had been trying to convince company management that they weren't printing enough copies, that when Children of Dune was printed soon in hardcover, it was going to be a national bestseller, purchased by more than science fiction fans. Like Dune, it would be a genre buster, he said. Dune itself had not made it onto very many bestseller lists, since its sales had been a gradual groundswell. Its sales since publication were impressive, and Dune Messiah had sold relatively well. But Dune Messiah hadn't been favorably received by the critics, and consensus held that its sales came on the coattails of Dune. Would Children of Dune, be an even bigger critical disappointment than Dune Messiah. There had never been a hardcover science fiction bestseller, so Putnam management proceeded with extreme caution. Suddenly, the analog results provided David Hartwell with the necessary ammunition. Putnam increased the first printing to 75,000 copies, instead of 7,500, more than any science fiction hardcover printing in history. Publication was scheduled for later in the year, after completion of the magazine's serialization. At Jan's encouragement, in the midst of the 1976 serialization, I began creative writing. I had in mind a satire about the workplace, based upon my experiences at insurance companies. When Dad discovered this, he became very excited and wanted to help. Thereafter, whenever we were in Port Townsend, Dad would say to me, "Let's talk story." And on his desk or a coffee table, I would spread my precious manuscript pages for his perusal. When Children of Dune came out in hardback in 1976, it was an instant bestseller. True to the predictions of David Hartwell and the gut feelings of my father, it became the top-selling hardback in science fiction history up to that time, more than 100,000 copies in a few months. "It's a runaway bestseller," Dad told me in a telephone conversation. He enjoyed this phrase, and I heard it often in ensuing years for much larger print runs. Children of Dune was nominated for the 1976 Hugo Award for the Best Novel of the Year, as determined by science fiction fans, but lost to The Forever War by Joe Haldeman. At the age of 55, Dad went on his first book tour, and it was a big one. 21 cities in 30 days, including an appearance on The Today Show in New York City with fellow science fiction writers Frederick Pohl and Lester Del Rey. The Literary Guild made arrangements to offer all three books of the Dune trilogy in a boxed hardbound set. When Children came out in paperback the following year, Berkeley Books initially printed 750,000 copies. This wasn't half enough, and they went back to press. 6 months after release of the paperback, Dad said paperback sales were approaching 2 million copies. By the end of 1977, Dune alone had sold more than 5 million copies in 9 languages, while trilogy sales totaled nearly 8 million copies. At the vanguard of an explosive growth of sales in science fiction, Frank Herbert blazed the trail for other writers in his genre. After his phenomenal success, Isaac Asimov, Arthur C. Clarke, Robert Heinlein, Ray Bradbury, and other science fiction writers had national bestsellers. In October 1976, Mom and Dad made their third trip to Europe, largely to see what was going on with Alejandro Jodorowsky's Dune movie project. They had been receiving second-hand information that the production was not going well. As was usual with trips my mother went on, she first underwent a battery of tests at Group Health Hospital and received her doctor's blessing. In Paris, Dad and Mom met with representatives of the French Film Consortium holding the rights to film Dune, and received bad news. Jodorowsky's script was too complex and would result in a mind-boggling 14-hour film. He had spent $2 million getting the project underway, and it was becoming increasingly clear that the film could not be produced for anywhere near the $9,500,000 budget. To make matters worse, Jodorowsky, a left-winger politically, and Salvador Dali, a right-winger, were refusing to work with one another, having had a vociferous argument in front of others involved in the project. Investors were getting wind of the production and personality problems, and funds were drying up. When my parents returned to the United States, they learned that Italian movie producer Dino De Laurentiis wanted to purchase the Dune film option from the French consortium. Dad had no objection, and as part of the new deal, he was retained as technical advisor and paid to write the screenplay. De Laurentiis had recently produced the $25 million special effects extravaganza King Kong, and my father quipped, "Anyone who can make a giant ape should have no trouble with sandworms." Early in his career, De Laurentiis had produced the critically acclaimed film Bitter Rice, starring the Italian bombshell Silvana Mangano, whom he married. He also backed two classic films directed by Federico Fellini, La Strada and Knights of Cabiria, much loved by critics and moviegoers. Subsequently, he became involved with big-budget spectaculars, such as The Bible, War and Peace, and a number of other films. While these and others were not well-received by critics, they were moneymakers. Though he didn't say so publicly, Dad was concerned that the movie mogul might turn his book into a Worm That Ate the Desert movie, a horror film about monster sandworms. Consequently, he insisted upon being technical advisor and screenplay writer for the film. Still, he was pleased that De Laurentiis had the financial resources necessary for the complexities of his epic desert saga, which seemed to require a long movie. De Laurentiis promised a film to compare with Gone with the Wind. With part of the movie advance, Dad purchased a new sailboat, which he christened Ganima, after Paul Muad'Dib's daughter. Ganima also meant, according to the terminology of the Imperium in Dune, something acquired in battle or single combat. My father's field of combat, for nearly four arduous decades, had been writing. Through 1976 and 1977, I used every moment of spare time to work on two humor books. After mailing each manuscript out in search of a publisher, I had a tendency to worry about its fate. Dad counseled me not to do that, and that he always went right to work on another project immediately after mailing out a story. My humor books didn't sell. The writing was hard work for me, did not come naturally. I wrote and rewrote and rewrote again. In the process, I began to understand what my father had been through in all the years he spent sequestered from this world, creating other worlds. I didn't forgive him, but I understood his life and motivations a little better. I gained new respect for what he had accomplished. This was an important step toward reconciliation with him. There would be others. Around this time, I had a conversation with Dad about my difficult childhood. It was a dry, crisp day late in the fall, and we were on a walk in the woods on the Olympic Peninsula, at the crest of a hill where the trees thinned out and a broad grassy field opened up before us. Dad was bundled up in a puffy down coat, bright orange in color, while I wore a nylon jacket, open at the front. Craggy snowy mountains and a ridge of clouds were visible beyond, profiled against a pale blue ice-beautiful sky. A cool breeze sent leaves scuttling across our path and rattled dry leaves that still clung to a nearby aspen. We took shelter in a stand of cottonwood trees, where I told him my feelings, and he listened. I told him it was wonderful what he had done for Mom to save her life, and that I appreciated the interest he had recently taken in me. But I told him that Bruce and I had been in a lot of pain for a long time. I asked him rhetorically why he had used a lie detector on us when we were little. There were other questions as well, in a similar vein. I had practiced what I would say to him 100 times, running over the exact words as I drove to and from work, as I sat at my desk, and as I lay awake agonizing in the middle of the night. Now, they didn't come out as I wanted them to. They needed editing, polishing, reworking. They were too harsh, too direct, too emotional. As I spoke, I felt a shortness of breath from the outpouring, and I expected him to explode at any moment with an all-too-familiar burst of temper. Without protestation, he listened to my diatribe. His arms were folded across his chest, and he shifted on his tennis-shoed feet uneasily. His eyes were filled with pain, and as I glared at him, he looked beyond me or at the sky or at the ground, rarely meeting my gaze. When I finished, he looked up and said, in an unsteady voice, "They were difficult times. My work. I had to do my work." His lips quivered, and words caught in his throat, not making their way out. This man of many stories, this master of words, could not speak. He gazed toward the mountains, and I saw tears welling in his blue eyes, rimming the lower lids. I took a deep breath, and after a long moment, I hugged him. He was shaking, and when he hugged me back, he was like a clumsy bear, powerful but gentle. As we pulled apart, he wiped his eyes quickly and wouldn't meet my gaze. I felt like a parent who had scolded a naughty child and said to him gently, "Dad, I love you. I'm sorry I had to say those things, but..." My voice trailed off. Now he met my gaze, and his eyes flashed intensely. "I love you, number one son," he said. He smiled reassuringly, then started toward the path. "We'd better get back, Brian. Your mother is fixing pot roast and wild blackberry pie." As we returned along a narrow path, pushing brush aside to get through, I knew he had apologized in his own way, and that I had forgiven him. I knew as well, but did not say to him, that my siblings and I competed with other children for his attention. the stories that were the offspring of his creative mind. When we lived with him, the story children had been easier to control than their human counterparts, and received more love than we did. As weeks passed, my father and I went on fishing, oyster digging, and crabbing trips together, and enjoyed many fine feasts afterward. We began kidding one another and laughing a lot, the way people do when they like one another and the relationship is new and fresh. If I said, "How you doing?" or something of equivalent silliness, he would point off in the distance and say in a mock gruff tone, "Go to your room." These were not welcome words to me when I was a child, not in the least, and he knew that. Now, in using them with a different tone and a wide smile on his bearded face and little laugh crinkles under his eyes, he was softening my harsh memories. This is not to say that Frank Herbert became perfect. He remained an incessant nitpicker about the smallest and most insignificant of details, disagreeable and impatient too often with children, and a grouchy bear before dinner. He drove his car too fast, frightening the passengers, pedestrians, and other drivers. He didn't like to admit weakness or fault. But I was crossing things off my list, replacing old bitterness with new, fond memories. For the first time in my life, I could say with pride that I had a loving, attentive father. Chapter 23. Caretakers of the Earth. During one of our walks at Xanadu, my father told me that none of us own real estate. "We are only stewards," he said, "charged with taking care of the planet for our grandchildren." This philosophy became, in Chapter House Dune, a tenet of the Bene Gesserit sisterhood. Similarly, he wrote in his short story Death of a City, 1973, only the species owned land, owned cities. On his 6-acre Port Townsend farm, Frank Herbert finally established his Ecological Demonstration Project, EDP, to explore the application of alternative energy sources, such as wind, solar, and methane gas. From Dune to New World or No World to the Green Brain, he wrote frequently about the environment, presenting frightening images of world ecological systems in trouble. His famous EDP was a Frank Herbert story in and of itself, one in which he learned by doing, as he liked to say, the best way of learning anything. He started it largely because he wanted to practice what he had been preaching. For years he had been crisscrossing the United States talking about environmental issues, and for a long time he had wanted to get his hands dirty, performing experiments that would bring the discussion out of the realm of theory and into the realm of application.
When he began the EDP shortly before the Arab oil crisis of 1973 to 1974, he spoke of a 5-year plan.
In that time frame, he hoped to prove it was possible to live in comfort while only drawing small amounts of resources from the public energy system. However, my mother's illness and other factors prevented him from meeting this deadline, one of the few times in the life of this journalist that he did not meet a deadline. Xanadu was one of his visions for mankind's future, in which he was developing methods by which modern man might utilize the resources of the planet efficiently, with minimal harm to the environment. As he spoke, I thought of Leto II in Children of Dune, receiving the visions from his father, Paul Atreides, when the Elder's time was past. A great deal of misinformation about Frank Herbert's EDP has circulated in the science fiction and environmental communities, principally that my father intended to become entirely self-sufficient, producing 100% of his food and energy needs. Dad said that was like the myth of the perpetual motion machine, a machine that could operate without external influence. "We're all part of society," he said. "We can't stop interacting with it." During his entire life, Frank Herbert shopped in food markets and never disconnected his homes from public utility systems. Through experimentation, he just utilized these facilities less than most people, and espoused that others follow his lead. Dad coined an interesting word for self-sufficiency, no matter the degree of application. He called it techno-peasantry, almost an oxymoron, and spoke of the particular adaptability of Americans to such systems. He always said we were a nation of screwdriver mechanics, with a lot of people who didn't mind getting their hands dirty. My parents' modified A-frame house featured vaulted ceilings and large windows, with large sheets of glass in each gable, all the way to the eaves. The glass was single pane, so it was not the most efficient home to heat, They had an oil furnace with a 200-gallon tank, but were considering the installation of a forced air wood-burning system. Before doing that, Dad wanted to try solar power, which he believed held great promise for solving his heating problems. With the assistance of an environmental housing expert, he designed a passive solar collection system that he hoped would reduce his dependence upon heating oil by around 50%. The results were slightly better than that. Even on 50-degree days, when the sun was partially or completely behind clouds, the system produced 72-degree heat. In fact, heat even came out of the system in the middle of the night, despite the absence of a heat storage facility in the design. Dad was amused by this, and found it baffling. The solar energy system, built on the south roof of the house just above the greenhouse, had simple panels made of plywood, large sheets of thermopane glass, and remarkably, aluminum beer cans. It had fiberglass insulation. To keep the cost down, thermopane seconds were used, which had small scratches on them. A control panel with a cedar cover was installed on one wall of the living room. For solar heat collectors, a few inches behind the thermopane, they set up banks of aluminum beer cans cut in half horizontally with a power saw and attached so that their cupped insides faced the sun. The solar collector system comprised an area of 145 square feet, set in six panels. In one of the panels, the cans were painted entirely flat black with high-temperature paint. In another panel, the cans were left unpainted in a plain aluminum color. And in the remaining four panels, the cans were only painted black on their interior bottoms, leaving the rest in their natural aluminum reflective state. Through experimentation, Dad found that the completely black cans absorbed slightly more infrared heat, making them more desirable for this application. It was a convection heat redistribution system, in which he used the furnace fan to circulate the air into the solar collectors and back into the house. He used approximately 1,750 aluminum beer cans, most of which were purchased from a recycling center. Still, he liked to imply other sources, quipping, "I received a lot of help from my friends putting the system together." While Dad got this passive solar system going, he still believed solar technology was too expensive for the average household. He wanted to develop a low-cost alternative energy system for homeowners, something that could be sold in Sears or Ward's catalogs for $500 or less. Until the prices for solar collection technology came down, he thought wind power might be the best answer to produce electricity, which would in turn be converted to heat. Dad found that buildings used more energy for heating when the wind blew because of the wind chill factor, and came up with an ingenious solution. If a building had a windmill for generating electricity, it could offset the cooling effect of the wind, flattening out the heat loss curve by turning a generator and warming a house electrically whenever the wind blew. The harder the wind blew, the more it would heat. He built a sturdy concrete-walled shop on the hill above his house, intending to construct a second-level conference center with guest bunks sometime in the future. In this scenario, he had dreams of teaching writing classes and of conducting courses on environmental issues for corporate and political leaders. All electrical and heating needs for the conference center would be provided by on-site systems. Above the conference center there would be, someday, a 30-foot concrete tower with a windmill on top. In studying wind technology, he found there had been very few advances since the invention of the horizontal axis Dutch windmill in the 16th century. He envisioned developing something that focused wind power and employed modern aerodynamic principles. Working with an architect, he designed and patented a cylindrical vertical axis windmill with a horn on top that focused and concentrated the wind. Air passing through the horn spun a vertical shaft by pushing vanes on it, and this in turn activated an automobile alternator, producing AC electricity. The device had no gears or belts and was very simple, with relatively few parts. Dad had a 4-foot-high, 4-foot-diameter prototype built, which was mounted on a truck chassis and connected to a calibrated speedometer for testing. The unit, self-propelled and drivable on public roadways, enabled them to estimate that a 10-inch-tall unit having a 3-foot diameter could produce 1 horsepower in a 50-mile-per-hour wind. Frank Herbert also developed a rather unusual methane gas-generating system by slitting a large truck tire inner tube, filling it with chicken and duck manure and straw, and then patching the tube. A piece of flexible rubber tubing was attached to the tube at the unsealed valve stem, with a spigot on the other end of the tubing. As the manure and straw decomposed, it produced pressurized methane gas, which Dad used to singe the feathers off chickens and ducks he had slaughtered. He also connected the apparatus to a gas heater and heated the poultry house. Due to the danger of methane explosion, the listener should not attempt to replicate this system. He believed that methane had potential large-scale applications for cities, which could convert sewage into methane gas for the operation of city vehicles, including buses. The byproduct would be fertilizer, useful in gardens and farms. On his own farm, my father shoveled poultry manure into buckets and spread it on the vegetable gardens. Frank Herbert always had plans to improve his solar, wind, and methane systems. But the development, maintenance, and promotion of his ecological experiments were taking too much of his valuable time. He decided to reorder his priorities, and as the 1970s drew to a close, his ecological demonstration project took a back burner. There were novels to write, book tours, and above all my mother's health, which required constant monitoring. Chapter 24 Miracles. In 1977, my father's novel, The Dosati Experiment, was published in hardcover by Putnam, after its serialization in Galaxy, May through August issues. Like the earlier novel Whipping Star and a number of earlier short stories, Dosati featured George X. McKee and the Bureau of Sabotage. Dosati sold well, and when Berkeley released the paperback the following year, it became a national bestseller, one of their top-selling science fiction titles of all time. That year, Babe passed away of a stroke while visiting her favorite sister Peggy Roundtree in Tacoma. She was 76. Her services were held at a Catholic church in Tacoma, an old building downtown. As the priest spoke, I sat behind Mom and Dad, and I recall seeing his head shaking back and forth constantly, an involuntary condition whenever he was very tired or feeling too much stress. Though my father was not a formally religious man, he could, like my mother, be spiritual at times. In the limousine as we rode to the cemetery, he said, "There is a place for ceremony." He also said drivers kept their vehicle lights on in a funeral procession to light the darkness for the one who had passed on. George Lucas's hit movie Star Wars came out the same year. The film was shocking to me, for all the similarities between it and my father's book, Dune. Both featured an evil galactic empire, a desolate desert planet, hooded natives, strong religious elements, and a messianic hero with an aged mentor. Star Wars Princess Leia had a name with a haunting similarity to Dune's Lady Aaliyah of the noble house Atreides. The movie also had spice mines and a dune sea. I phoned my father and said, "You'd better see it. The similarities are unbelievable." When Dad saw the movie, he picked out 16 points of what he called absolute identity between his book and the movie, enough to make him livid. He thought he saw the ideas of other science fiction writers on the screen as well, including those of Isaac Asimov, Larry Niven, Ted Sturgeon, Barry Maltzberg, and Jerry Pournelle. Still, Frank Herbert tried to be upbeat. He and the other science fiction writers who thought they saw their work in Lucas's movie formed a loose organization that my father called, with his tongue firmly placed in his cheek, the We're Too Big to Sue George Lucas Society. Through humor, Dad tried to mask the pain. One of his biggest concerns, Star Wars made the filming of Dune an even bigger challenge than before, even more insurmountable because of the important concepts that had now been preempted on the screen. Not the least of these was the young hero of Star Wars, Luke Skywalker, who, like Paul Atreides of Dune, had messianic qualities with a link to a mystical religious force. That year, my sister Penny and brother Bruce were visiting for the Thanksgiving holiday, staying in Port Townsend. During his visit, Bruce confided to me for the first time that he was gay, and said one of the reasons he felt he had taken this course was because of the terrible example his own father had been for him. After seeing how Dad treated children, Bruce said, "I didn't want to have any." He asked me not to discuss it with Mom or Dad yet, since he wasn't sure how he wanted to break it to them. I thought of, but did not comment on, Mom's desire for a boy grandchild to carry on the Herbert family name. I didn't know anything about the gay community, didn't know what to say to him. I told him I loved him anyway, that his sexual preference would never change how I felt for him. but I felt awkward discussing the subject. Words did not come easily. Bruce was a studious young eccentric, a genius in electronics who built and maintained sound systems and other equipment for San Francisco rock and roll groups, and for celebrities, such as the actor Stuart Whitman. My brother always carried little pen-shaped television adjustment tools in his shirt pocket, which he used to keep all sets in the Herbert family operating at their optimum. He made a steady stream of unlucky business decisions and investments, however, and seemed unable to keep his financial house in order. But Bruce was brilliant. In the 1960s, he invented the karaoke music system. Without naming it or attempting to exploit it commercially, he simply set it up for personal use in his own household. In June 1978, Dad interrupted his writing schedule to travel to Metz, France, with Mom, where he was guest of honor at an immense science fiction convention. My mother kept one of her rare journals on this trip. That year, the Dune movie project had fallen apart for the third time. Producer Dino De Laurentiis decided Dad's screenplay was unworkable, and based upon further research, thought the book might be too complicated to ever be reproduced on film. He did this despite feeling drawn to Dune and thinking that it might be a big hit. Upon hearing that my father would be in Europe, Dino De Laurentiis asked Dad if he could lend a hand with the screenplay for a science fiction movie that was being filmed in England and was in trouble, his $35 million production of Flash Gordon. Dad agreed to help and spent a month in London working on the project. To do the patch-up job, Dad purchased an ultra-lightweight manual typewriter, much lighter and more compact than his old Olympia portable. In the hotel suite he shared with Mom at the Grosvenor House on Park Lane, he set the typewriter keys in motion. Dad and De Laurentiis enjoyed working with one another, and the popular movie that resulted was given high marks by a number of critics. My parents took a side trip by air shuttle to Edinburgh, Scotland, the country of my mother's paternal ancestry. They took a drive along the coast, and like characters in Wuthering Heights, one of my mother's favorite novels, they had a romantic walk across the heather-covered moors and climbed a hill for a magnificent view of a white sand beach. One day in Edinburgh, they opted to ride a double-decker city bus. They sat on the upper deck at the rear, on a wide seat with other people. A man next to my father pulled out a pack of cigarettes and a lighter, and as he was lighting up, inquired of those around him, "Does anyone mind if I smoke?" He had the cigarette lit before the question was completed. In a tense voice, Dad told him to put it out. Nervously, the man dropped the lighted cigarette on the floor and crushed it out under his shoe. Ever since Mom's brush with death, Dad had become fanatical against anyone smoking in his or my mother's presence. Returning from Europe, Dad found himself under pressure to complete a number of projects at once. One day he showed up at the door of his friend Bill Ransom and inquired, "Can you write like me?" He needed help with a short story for a project inspired by Harlan Ellison called Medea, Harlan's World. My father's story was slated for publication in Analog prior to the Ellison collection. Bill, a Pulitzer Prize nominee for poetry 3 years before, said he would try to help. He proceeded to write the first draft of the story, which they titled Songs of a Sentient Flute. Dad edited the manuscript and typed the final draft, making additional changes as he did so. Dad was also being pressed by Putnam to come up with a new science fiction novel, so he and Bill brainstormed and came up with a way of using the same concept for the short story and for the novel. They laid out Songs of a Sentient Flute with the idea of expanding it into a novel entitled The Jesus Incident, which would be a sequel to Destination Void. So, on the same day that they mailed Songs of a Sentient Flute to Analog, they also sent it to their agent Lurton Blessingame in the form of a book proposal for The Jesus Incident. Putnam offered a substantial contract to publish the novel in hardcover, and Dad and Bill set to work on it. Bill, who had many shared interests with my father, was only a couple of years older than I was. He had an intelligent oval face and long black hair combed straight back. In the novel, he and my father alternated chapters, using a leapfrogging technique, after which they edited one another's work. Their styles meshed so closely that even my mother, who knew her husband's style better than anyone, could not identify the writer of particular sections. Despite strong egos, the men did not clash because of the high regard they held for one another. Mom often heard them laughing uproariously in the loft study as one or the other came up with a bon mot for the developing tale. To a great extent, the collaboration was a quid pro quo. Frank Herbert received assistance with a short story and a novel from an energetic, talented young writer, and in return, Bill Ransom was given a rare opportunity to learn at the elbow of a master. Bill told me, "The key thing that I wanted to learn from Frank was how to maintain a story for a novel length, because working in poetry, I'd always been focused on making things smaller." Bill also felt he needed to learn a lot more about literary description, which was one of Dad's strengths. One day, upon looking at a passage written by his young collaborator, my father told him to rewrite it with more sensory detail. "Look, Bill," he said, "we need to smell this guy right in the armpits." Bill worked hard and learned quickly, but when the Jesus incident was nearly complete, a major crisis occurred. Ellison learned they were using the same planet and characters as in Songs of a Sentient Flute, and he got his book publisher, Fantasia Press, and the publisher of Analog involved. They told Dad and Bill to cease and desist, that they were using material they didn't own. Dad made an emergency trip to New York City, where he met with his agent and the publishers involved. When he returned to Port Townsend, he was extremely upset and nervous. "We can't use the planet, the characters, or any of that," he told Bill. "Harlan Ellison owns the rights to them." Thereafter, they rewrote the Jesus incident, changing the names of characters, locales, and other details. The racial background of one character was altered, but aside from that, the basic characterizations were not changed. They rewrote problematical passages and tried to make the plot that they had already written fit. It took 2 weeks of non-stop rewriting, and they kept a professional typist working into the wee hours. The collaboration had ceased to be fun, and instead of heady, joking sessions, long periods went by without laughter. When at last they finished, little gaps were apparent in the story, and they weren't particularly happy with it, especially with the way they had to end it. Nonetheless, the book was accepted for publication, and sales were brisk. While working with my father, Bill Ransom had an opportunity to watch the interaction between my parents over an extended period of time. They were physically passionate toward one another, he said, and often took breaks alone during the day. To Bill's amusement, they were open about the reason for this and laughed about it. He enjoyed teasing them on the subject. Bill also observed my parents as a writing team, in which Beverly, for a long time Frank's reader, became the reader for the product of the Herbert Ransom collaboration. "That was where she really shined," Bill said, adding that her comments contained detailed reasons and suggestions, not just general statements. He saw the mountains of other work she did as well, including the financial management that she performed and the handling of voluminous correspondence that came in from fans, agents, publishers, and other writers. He noticed, too, how she screened calls and inquiries and kept people away from Dad so that he could create, and how she coordinated all interviews and public appearances. In a very real sense, I was struggling to know my father, just as he was struggling to know me. We were trying to make up for lost time. We went on long walks together, and I helped him around the farm, feeding poultry, tending to plantings, working in the shop. It had been a long and difficult road to this point in my father's life, a road from tattered rental houses and unpaid bills to worldwide fame. In the Old Testament, it was said that the skin of Moses shone when he came down from Mount Sinai with the Ten Commandments. This phenomenon had been noticed as well about successful people at the heights of their careers. They glow. And so it was with my father, at the pinnacle of his success. Through it all, I still had dimensions of this man to discover. There were nooks and crannies in his marvelous mind and in his emotional makeup that I didn't know existed. He was not as strong as I had always imagined. Dad was more vulnerable to comments from me than I thought he would be. I told him I had been reading his books, and that I thought Dune was more smoothly written, more polished than The Dragon in the Sea, a book written a decade before Dune. I was talking about style, having noticed a certain choppiness in the earlier work when it was laid down beside the later one, with its beautiful poetic prose. He was obviously hurt at my remark, for he said simply, "Dragon is one of my favorite stories." Of course he would feel this way, for it had been his first book sale, and it was a fine book, a well-told story. Another time we were outside on the patio, preparing the fire pit for a pig we were going to roast. It was a cool day, and he wore a sheepskin vest to cut the chill. As I looked at my bearded father in his vest, I was struck with the similarities between him and Ernest Hemingway. Beyond beards and sheepskin vests, both were great riders and outdoorsmen. Both had more than a little machismo. I kidded Dad about his vest, asking him if he was playing Hemingway. He seemed displeased by the observation, and didn't laugh. Rather awkwardly, rather late, I was learning how not to hurt my father's feelings. I also received advice from my mother, who was pleased with the improving relationship. "It's not too late for you to be close," she told me. In 1978, Berkeley published a trade paperback, The Illustrated Dune, with a dozen illustrations by John Schoenherr, the artist who had done such a wonderful job on Dune subjects. A Dune calendar was printed with the same artwork. Dad had intended to end the Dune series with Children of Dune, which he saw as the completion of a cycle. But the characters and settings he had created would not die. His trilogy became so popular that requests for more Dune books poured in from fans, and all the editors involved, domestic and foreign, were asking for more as well. In considering the prospect of a fourth book, it occurred to Frank Herbert that the universe of Dune was a canvas, and that he might resume the series on the planet Dune 3,500 years later. This would require a new set of characters, but they would be linked genetically with people in the past. He began reviewing the first three books in the series, making notes as thoughts occurred to him. New file folders sprang up around him like mushrooms, and he started writing more about a most unusual character from Children of Dune, Leto II, a noble human of the Atreides family who was evolving into a sandworm. That year I began collecting wine labels from the dinners with my parents, soaking labels off bottles at home and drying them out. On the backs of the labels, I made brief notations of the events in the family, a few highlights. When we ate at my parents' home, we invariably had Dad's special Caesar salad dressing, which he prepared with great care and divided among the hungry diners. It was so good that no matter how much he prepared, there never seemed to be enough. After many years of being dependent upon Dad and taxis for transportation, Mom obtained a driver's license and her own car, a sporty new light green BMW. At the age of 51. She loved the independence it gave her, but Dad wasn't nearly as enthusiastic. He worried about her constantly and missed her terribly whenever she was away. When Jan's father, Ray Blanky, died that year, my mother came from Port Townsend to drive Jan to the airport for a flight to the funeral in California. Entering our kitchen, Mom found Jan at the table going through photographs of her father. "Oh, no," Mom said, "don't look at those." Gently, she put the pictures away. At the airport, Mom took Jan to a restaurant where they shared a meal. Mom said not to worry about anything on this end, that she would stay with me and the kids. Jan was looking out on the tarmac, thinking of her father, and my mother remarked gently, "When you lose somebody, you have to gather your skirts and go on." In February 1979, Dino De Laurentiis made his second deal with my father for the rights to film Dune, after having let the first option lapse. Dad said it was the second highest price ever paid for the screen rights to a book, behind only the amount paid to Peter Benchley for The Deep. Again, Dad was retained to write the screenplay. That month, a ferocious storm with 100-mile-per-hour winds hit the Hood Canal floating bridge, causing half of it to sink. Because of this, we had to ride substitute ferries, and it took us at least 3.5 to 4 hours to get to Port Townsend, almost twice as long as previously. A new bridge was in the planning stages, but would take time to complete. Shortly after the bridge went down, my parents caught a flight to New York City, where they met with some of the top figures in the New York publishing world. They were excited to hear that Dad was working on a fourth book in the Dune series, a book he thought he would name Sandworm of Dune. Then my parents flew to Paris and afterward to London, where they met with Dino De Laurentiis to discuss the Dune movie production. Upon returning from Europe, Mom prepared a Mexican dinner for us, served with a Chateau Bechevel red Bordeaux wine. They had a new Dune painting on the wall, recently purchased from the artist John Schoenherr. Now they owned 10 of these paintings and were negotiating to purchase 3 more. In my mother's post-cancer treatment program, she was continuing to swim laps of the pool and was taking half-mile walks 2 or 3 times a week. She was trying to lose weight so that her heart, damaged by radiation treatments, would not have to work so hard. For some time, however, Mom had been suffering in the cold, damp climate of the Pacific Northwest. She had been talking with Dad about finding a second home in a warmer climate where they could spend the winters. With the millions of dollars received from the movie, if it met revenue projections, Dad hoped to buy that second home for her. He was receiving huge book royalties every April and October for past book sales, and higher advances for each book he wrote. But too frequently he received an advance on a book and then spent it before actually completing the writing. Despite my mother's counseling, Dad was always spending money impulsively, putting them behind in their cash flow. One of the expense outlays involved a 44-foot sailboat, which Dad named Caladan, after the planet in the Dune universe where Paul Muad'Dib was born. The Ghanima, his smaller sailboat, was sold. Dad was also putting money into the design and construction of a new 10.5 million byte computer system, tailored to his needs by a young Port Townsend computer expert, Max Barnard. Dad and Max were talking about patenting the system and writing a computer book together. Around this time, I was feeling pretty discouraged about my own writing. I'd written two humor books and a novel, none of which were accepted by publishers. I was considering writing short stories. But one day I mentioned to Dad that I had a number of funny files that might be worked into humor books. One was a collection of classic comeback lines from history, and the other was a folder full of amusing insurance claims. Dad, with his interest in history, suggested that I proceed with the comeback lines book. I did so. I was also beginning to keep a full-fledged journal. Previously, my documentation of family events had involved only sketchy notations made on the backs of wine labels. Now I began asking my mother about genealogical matters, which I combined with current events and personal observations. As these notes accumulated, I had too much information to fit on the backs of small pieces of paper. My creative writing was not selling, but I began to notice an interesting phenomenon. Where once I had been the life of the party, the drunkest, funniest one present, I wasn't drinking much at all anymore. The more I wrote, especially in my journal, the less I drank, and the less I blamed my father for any of the woes of my life. With the assistance of journal entries, I was coming to the realization that no matter our backgrounds, no matter the troubles we endure, each of us has to grow up one day, accepting responsibility for our own lives, not blaming others. When we attempt to transfer fault to others, it frequently amounts to making excuses for our failures, thus creating the likelihood of future failures. Thus, if we do not succeed, we can always say it wasn't our fault. That fall, my father and I regularly sailed the Caladan on the cold blue waters of Port Townsend Bay. Frequently we brought along my daughters, 11-year-old Julie and 7-year-old Kim. With his competitive nature, Dad often raced other boats, and usually won. After sailing, we would go to nearby